But 3 hours after Drake's death, George Dorn lay on his bed in the Hotel Tudor, holding a phone to his ear, listening to it ring. A young woman's voice on the other end suddenly said,
"Hello?"
"I'd like to speak to Inspector Goodman," said George.
There was a momentary pause, then the voice said,
"Who's calling, please?"
"My name is George Dorn, but it probably wouldn't mean anything to the inspector. But would you ask him to come to the phone, please, and tell him I have a message for him about the case of Joseph Malik?"
There was a constricted silence, as if the woman on the other end of the phone wanted to scream and had stopped breathing. Finally, she said,
"My husband's working just now, but I'll be glad to give him any message you have."
"That's funny," said George. "I've been told Inspector Goodman's duty hours are noon to 9 p.m.
"I don't think it's any of your business where he is,"
the woman suddenly blurted. George felt a little shock. Rebecca Goodman was frightened, and she didn't know where her husband was. Something in the tone of her last three words revealed her mental state to George. "I must be getting more sensitive to people," he thought.
"Do you ever hear from him?"
he said gently. He was feeling sorry for Mrs. Inspector Saul Goodman, who was, come to think of it, the wife of a pig. If just a few years ago George had read in the paper that this woman's husband had been shot down at random by some unknown revolutionary-type assailants, he probably would have whispered,
"Right on."
One of George's own friends of that period might have killed Inspector Goodman. There was even a moment when George himself might have done it. Once, one of the kids in George's group had called up the young widow of a policeman killed one December by young blacks and called her a bitch and the wife of a pig and told her that her husband was guilty of crimes against the people and that those who had shot him would go down in history as heroes. George had approved of this verbal action as a means of hardening oneself against bourgeois sentimentality. The papers had been full of stories about how this policeman's three little kids would have no Christmas this year. Such tripe made George urgently want to throw up. But now this woman's anguish was coursing through the wire, and he was feeling it, just because her husband was not known to be dead, just missing. And probably not dead at all, otherwise why would Hagbard have said that George should get in touch with him?
I don't know what you mean,
she said. She was starting to break, George thought. In another minute she'd be blurting out all her fears to him. Well, for Christ's sake, he didn't know where Goodman was.
Look,
he said sharply, pushing back against the flow of emotion coming through to him.
If you hear from Inspector Goodman, tell him if he wants to know more about the Bavarian Illuminati, he should call George Dorn at the Hotel Tudor. That's D-O-R-N, Hotel Tudor. Have you got that?
The Illuminati? Look, Mr. Dorn, whatever you want to tell, you can tell me. I'll pass it on to him.
I can't do that, Mrs. Goodman. Thank you now. Goodbye.
Wait, don't hang up.
I can't help you, Mrs. Goodman. I don't know where he is either.
George dropped the phone into its cradle with a sigh. His hands were cold and moist. Well, he'd have to tell Hagbard he couldn't reach Inspector Goodman, but he had learned something, that Saul Goodman, who was supposed to be investigating Joe Malik's disappearance, had himself disappeared, and the words Bavarian Illuminati meant something to his wife. George crossed the small room and turned on the TV. The new news would be on. He went back to his bed, lay down, and lit a cigarette. He was still exhausted from his sexual bout of the night before with Tarantella Serpentine. The announcer said,
"The Attorney General has announced that he will speak at 6 this evening on the early morning epidemic of gangland-style assassinations at widely separated locations all over the country. The death toll from killings of this type has reached 27, though local officials refuse to say whether all or any of these deaths are connected. Among those shot are Senator Edward Coke Bacon, two high-ranking Los Angeles police officers, the mayor of a town called Mad Dog, Texas, a New York fight promoter, a Boston pharmacist, a Detroit ceramicist, a Chicago communist, three New Mexico hippie leaders, a New Orleans restaurateur, a barber in Yorba Linda, California, and a sausage manufacturer in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. There were bomb explosions at 15 locations, killing 13 more people. Six persons around the country have disappeared, and four of these were being seen forced into cars at different times last night and this morning. The Attorney General today called this a reign of terror perpetrated by organized crime, pointing out that though the motives for the widely scattered slayings is obscure, they bear the earmarks of gangster killings. However, new FBI Director George Wallace, who has ordered FBI agents around the country into action, issued a written statement declaring, quote, Once again, the Attorney General has treed the wrong coon, proving that law enforcement should be left to the experienced professionals. We have reason to think that these murders are the work of Negro communists, directed from Peking. End of quote. Meanwhile, the Office of the Vice President has issued an apology to the Italian-American Anti-Defamation League for his reference to mafioso rubouts, and the League has withdrawn its picket line from the White House. Remember, the Attorney General will address the nation at 6 p.m. tonight.
The announcer suddenly changed his facial expression from neutral newscaster to pugnacious patriot.
Certain dissident elements keep complaining that people don't get a chance to participate in decisions made by their government. Yet at a time like this, when the whole nation has an opportunity to hear the Attorney General, the ratings are not always as good as they should be. So let's do everything we can to build up those ratings tonight, and let the whole world know that this is still a democracy.
Fuck!
George shouted at the screen. He didn't recall TV newscasters being that obnoxious. Must be a fairly recent development, something that had happened after he left for Mad Dog. Maybe a late outgrowth of the Fernando Poo crisis. It was in this very hotel, George remembered, after the bloody Fernando Poo demonstrations at the UN, that Joe Malik first broached the subject of Mad Dog. Now Joe had disappeared, not unlike those people who, as George knew, the syndicate had snuffed in earnest of their good intentions, having accepted Hagbard's gift of objets d'art. Not unlike Inspector Saul Goodman, who perhaps had gone down the same rabbit hole as Joe. There was a knock at the door. George went to it, turning off the TV set in passing. It was Stella Maris.
Well, glad to see you, baby. Strip off that dress and come over to the bed, so we can reaffirm my initiation rites.
Stella put her hands on his shoulders.
Never mind that now, George. We've got things to worry about. Robert Putney Drake and Banana Nose Maldonado are dead. Come on, we've got to get back to Hagbard right away.
Traveling first by helicopter, then by executive jet, and finally by motorboat to Hagbard's Chesapeake Bay submarine base, George was exhausted and dazed in terror's aftermath. He rallied when he saw Hagbard again.
You motherfucker! You sent me to get goddamn killed!
And that has given you the courage to tell me off,
said Hagbard with an indulgent smile.
Fear is a funny thing, isn't it, George? If we weren't afraid of dying of diseases, we'd never develop the science of microbiology. That science, in turn, creates the possibility of germ warfare, and each superpower is so afraid that the others may wage germ warfare against it, each develops its own plagues to wipe out the human race.
Your mind is wandering, you stupid old fart,
said Stella.
George isn't kidding about nearly being killed.
The fear of death is the beginning of slavery,
Hagbard said simply. Even though it was early, George found himself on the verge of collapse, ready to sleep for 24 hours or more. The submarine's engines vibrated under his feet as he trudged to his cabin, but he wasn't even curious about where they were going. He lay down on his bed and picked a book off the headpost bookshelf, part of his getting ready for sleep ritual.
Sexuality, magic, and perversion,
said the binder. Well, that sounded juicy and promising. Author named Francis King, whoever that is. Citadel Press, 1972. Only a few years ago.
Well then.
George opened at random.
Within a few years, Freighter Peregrinus had become chief of the Swiss section of the OTO, had entered into friendly relationships with the disciples of Aleister Crowley, notably Carl Germer, and had established a magazine. Subsequently, Freighter Peregrinus inherited the chieftainship of Crumheller's ancient Rosicrucian fraternity and the patriarchate of the Gnostic Catholic Church. This latter dignity he derived from Chevillian, murdered by the Gestapo in 1944, who was himself the successor of Johnny Breycod. Freighter Peregrinus is also the head of one of the several groups who claim to be the true heirs and successors of the Illuminati of Weishaupt, as revived, circa 1895, by Leopold Engel.
George blinked. Several Illuminati? He had to ask Hagbard about this, but he was already beginning to visualize into hypnagogic reverie, and sleep was coming. In less than a half hour, Joe had distributed 92 paper cups of tomato juice containing OM, the drug that promised to turn neophobes into neophiles. He stood in Pioneer Court, just north of the Michigan Avenue Bridge, at a table from which hung a poster reading, Free Tomato Juice. Each person who took a cupful was invited to fill out a short questionnaire and leave it in a box on Joe's table. However, Joe explained, the questionnaire was optional, and anyone who wanted to drink the tomato juice and run was welcome to do so. Om would work just as well either way, but the questionnaire would give Elf an opportunity to trace its effect on some of the subjects. A tall black policeman was suddenly standing in front of the table.
You got a permit for this?
You bet,
said Joe with a quick smile.
I'm with the General Services Corporation, and we're running a test on a new brand of tomato juice. Care to try some, officer?
No thanks,
said the cop unsmilingly.
We had a bunch of yippies threatening to put LSD in the city's water supply 2 years ago. Let's just see your credentials.
There was something cold, hard, and homicidal in this cop's eyes, Joe thought. Something beyond the ordinary. This would be a unique guy, and the stuff would affect him uniquely. Joe looked down at the nameplate on the policeman's jacket, which read Waterhouse. The line behind Patrolman Waterhouse was getting longer. Joe found the paper Malaclips had given him. He handed it to Waterhouse, who glanced at it and said,
This isn't enough. You apparently didn't tell them you're going to set up your stand in Pioneer Court. You're blocking pedestrian traffic here. This is a busy area. You have to move.
Joe looked out at the street where crowds walked back and forth, at the bridge across the green, greasy Chicago River, and at the buildings surrounding Pioneer Court. The brick-paved area was an ample public square, and there was clearly room for everyone. Joe smiled at Waterhouse. He was in Chicago and knew what to do. He took a $10 bill out of his pocket, folded it twice lengthwise, and wrapped it around a cup of the tomato juice, which he deftly filled from the plastic jug on his table. Waterhouse drained the tomato juice without comment, and when he tossed the cup into the wastebasket, the $10 bill was gone. A bunch of bald-headed, cackling, small-town businessman types was lined up in front of the table. Each one wore an acetate-covered badge bearing a red Crusader's cross, the letters KCUF, and the words, Dominus Vobiscum, my name is... Joe smilingly handed them cups of tomato juice, noting that the lapels of several bore an additional decoration, a square white plastic cross with the letters CL printed across it. Any of these men, Joe knew, would love to put him in jail for the rest of his life, because he was the publisher of a radical magazine that occasionally got very explicit about sex and several times had published what Joe considered very beautiful erotica. The Knights of Christianity United for the Faith were rumored to be behind the firebombing of two theaters in the Midwest and the lynching of a news dealer in Alabama. And, of course, they had close ties with Atlanta Hope's God's Lightning Party.
Om would be strong medicine for this bunch,
Joe thought. He wondered if it would get them off their censorship kick or just make them more formidable. In either case, they would be bound to bust loose from Illuminati control for a time. If only there were a way he and Simon could get into their convention and administer Om to more of them. Behind the KCUF contingent, there was a small man who looked like a rooster with a gray comb. When Joe read the questionnaire later, he found out that he had administered Om to Judge Caligula Bushman, a shining ornament of the Chicago judiciary. There followed a succession of faces Joe did not find memorable. They all had that complex, stupid, shrewd, angry, defeated, cynical, gullible look characteristic of Chicago, New York, and other big cities. Then he found himself confronting a tall redhead whose features seemed to combine the best of Elizabeth Taylor and Marilyn Monroe.
Any vodka in that?
She asked him.
No, ma'am. Just straight tomato juice,
said Joe.
Too bad,
she said as she tossed it down.
I could use one.
Caligula Bushman, known as the toughest judge on the Chicago bench, was trying six people who were charged with attacking a draft board, destroying all its furniture, ruining its files, and dumping a wheelbarrow full of cow manure on the floor. Suddenly, Bushman interrupted the trial about halfway through the prosecution's presentation of its case with the announcement that he was going to hold a sanity hearing. To the bewilderment of all, he then asked State's Attorney Milo A. Flanagan a series of rather odd questions.
What would you think of a man who not only kept an arsenal in his home, but was collecting at enormous financial sacrifice a second arsenal to protect the first one? What would you say if this man so frightened his neighbors that they in turn were collecting weapons to protect themselves from him? What if this man spent 10 times as much money on his expensive weapons as he did on the education of his children? What if one of his children criticized his hobby and he called that child a traitor and a bum and disowned it? And he took another child who had obeyed him faithfully and armed that child and sent it out into the world to attack neighbors? Well, what would you say about a man who introduces poisons into the water he drinks and the air he breathes? What if this man not only is feuding with the people on his block, but involves himself in the quarrels of others in distant parts of the city and even in the suburbs? Such a man would clearly be a paranoid schizophrenic, Mr. Flanagan, with homicidal tendencies. This is the man who should be on trial. Though under our modern enlightened system of jurisprudence, we would attempt to cure and rehabilitate him rather than merely punish. Speaking as a judge,
he continued,
I dismiss this case on several grounds. The state is clinically insane as a corporate entity and is absolutely unfit to arrest, try, and incarcerate those who disagree with its policies. But I doubt that this judgment, though obvious to any man of common sense, quite fits into the rules of our American jurisprudential game. I also rule, therefore, that the right to destroy government property is protected by the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and therefore, the crime with which these people are charged is not a crime under the Constitution. Government property belongs to all of the people, and the right of any of the people to express their displeasure with their government by destroying government property is precious and shall not be infringed.
This doctrine had come to Judge Bushman suddenly while he was speaking without his robe. It startled him, but he had noticed that his mind was working better and faster this afternoon. He went on.
The state does not exist as a person or thing exists, but is a legal fiction. A fiction is a form of communication. Anything said to be owned by a form of communication must also thereby be itself a form of communication. Government is a map, and government paper is a map of the map. The medium in this case is definitely the message, as any semanticist would agree. Furthermore, any physical act directed against a communication is itself a communication, a map of the map of the map. Thus, destruction of government property is protected by the First Amendment. I will issue a more ample written opinion on this point, but I feel now that the defendants need suffer endurance no longer. Case dismissed.
Many spectators trooped out of the courtroom sullenly, while those who loved the defendants surrounded them with tears, laughter, and hugs. Judge Bushman, who stepped down from the bench but remained in the courtroom, was the benign center of a cluster of reporters. He was thinking that his opinion would be a map of the map of the map of the map, or a fourth-order map. How many potential further orders of symbolism were there? He barely heard the praises showered on him. Of course, he knew his decision would be overturned, but the judge business already bored him. It would be interesting to get into mathematics, really deep. Harold Canvera had not bothered to fill out a questionnaire, and therefore was not under observation and was not protected. He returned to his home and his job as an accountant, and his avocation, which was recording telephone spiels against the Illuminati, the communists, the socialists, the liberals, the middle-of-the-roaders, and all insufficiently conservative Republicans. Mr. Canvera also mailed out similar pamphlets whenever anybody was intrigued enough by his phone messages to send him 25 cents for additional information. He performed these worthy educational services for a group calling itself White Heroes Opposing Red Extremism, which was a splinter off Taxpayers Warring Against Tyranny, which was a splinter off God's Lightning. In the following weeks, however, strange new ideas began to appear in Canvera's taped phone messages.
Lower taxes aren't enough,
he said, for instance.
When you hear some so-called conservative bircher or some follower of William Buckley Jr. call for lower taxes, beware. There's a man who's squishy soft on Illuminism. All taxes are robbery. Instead of attacking Joan Baez, a real American should support her for refusing to pay any more money into the Illuminati treasury in Washington.
The next week was even more interesting.
White Heroes Opposing Red Extremism has often told you that there's no real difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. Both are pawns of the Illuminati scheme to destroy private property and make everybody a slave of the state, so the international bankers of a certain minority group can run everything. Now it's time for all thinking patriots to take an even more skeptical look than ever before at the so-called anti-Illuminati John Birch Society. Why are they always putting up those stickers saying, support your local police? Ever wonder about that? What's the most important thing to a police state? Isn't it police? And if we got rid of the police, how could we ever have a police state? Think about it, fellow Americans, and remember the Alamo.
A few of these new strange ideas had come from various right-wing anarchist periodicals, all secretly subsidized by Hagbard Chalene, that Canvera had mysteriously received 3 months earlier and hadn't glanced at until swallowing the alm. These periodicals had been mailed by Simon Moon as a joke, in an envelope with the return address, Illuminati International, 34 East 68th Street, New York City, the headquarters of the Council on Foreign Relations, long regarded by the Birchers as an Illuminati hotbed. Remember the Alamo, Canvera had picked up from Bowie Knife, a publication of the Davy Crockett Society, a paramilitary right-wing fascist group which had splintered off God's lightning when their leader, a Texas oil millionaire of gigantic paranoias, became convinced that many apparent Mexicans were actually Red Chinese agents in slight disguise. Later, the dogma became retroactive, and he claimed that the Chinese had always been communists, all Mexicans had always been Chinese, and the attack on the Alamo was the first communist assault against American capitalism. The third week was quite remarkable. Evidently, Om, like LSD, changed some personality traits but left others fairly intact. In any event, in Canvera's irregular evolution from right-wing authoritarianism to right-wing libertarianism, he had somehow managed to arrive at a thesis never before enunciated, except by Donatien Alphonse François de Sade. What this rare man did was to give a 3-minute spiel in favor of the right of any person, of either sex, to use any other person, of either sex, with or without their consent, for sexual gratification of any sort needed, or at least desired. The only option he granted the recipients of these intimate invasions was the reciprocal right to use the initiator for their own needs or desires. Now, most of the people who regularly called Canvera's phone service were not offended by any of this. They were Lincoln Avenue hippies and dialed him only when stoned for what they called a really weird and far-out head trip. And they were bored that he was no longer as funky as in his old Negro-baiting, Jew-hating, and Illuminati-castigating days. However, there were a few members of the white heroes opposing red extremism who called occasionally to check that their contributions were still financing the dissemination of true Americanism. And these people were severely puzzled and finally disturbed. Some of them even wrote to Whore headquarters in Mad Dog, Texas, to complain that there was something a little bit peculiar in the Americanism lately. However, the president of Whore, Dr. Horace Naismith, who also ran the John Dillinger Died For You Society, Veterans of the Sexual Revolution, and the Colossus of Yorba Linda Foundation, was in it only for the money, sad to say, and had no time for such petty complaints. He was too busy implementing his newest fundraising scheme, the male chauvinist organization, Macho, which he hoped would milk mucho dineros from Russ Myers, illegal abortionists, pimps, industrialists who regularly paid female workers 30% of the salaries of men doing the same jobs, and all others threatened by the women's liberation movement. The fourth week was, to be frank about it, definitely bizarre. Canvera discoursed at length on the lost civilization that once existed in the Gobi Desert, and denounced those, such as Brian Geisen, who believed it had destroyed itself in atomic war. Rather, he asserted, it had been obliterated when the Illuminati arrived from the planet Vulcan in flying saucers. Remember the Alamo was now replaced by Remember Carcosa, Canvera having discerned that both Ambrose Bierce and H.P. Lovecraft were describing this tragic Gobian society in their fiction. The hippies were again delighted. This was the funky kind of trip that had originally made Canvera a mock folk hero among them. And they especially appreciated his call for the U.S. to abandon the next moonshot and launch a punitive expedition to Vulcan, both to wipe out Illuminism at its source and to avenge poor Carcosa. The Whore regulars, however, were again upset. All that concern with Carcosa struck them as creeping one-worldism. The fifth week, Canvera took a new turn, denouncing the masses for their stupidity and proclaiming that the boobs probably deserve being governed by the Illuminati, since most of them were too dumb to find their own behinds in a dark room, even using both hands. He had been browsing through a volume of H.L. Mencken, sent to him over a year earlier by Elhaj Stackerly Muhammad Ney Pearson, after one of his put prayers back in the public school tirades. But he had also been pondering an invitation to join the Illuminati. This document, which came in an envelope with no return address, informed him that he was too smart to stay with the losers all his life and ought to climb on the winning side before it was too late. It added that membership dues were $3,125, which should be put in a cigar box and buried in his backyard, after which it was promised, one of our underground agents will contact you. At first, Canvera had considered this a hoax. He received many put-ons in the mail, together with pornography, Rosicrucian pamphlets illustrated with the Iron Pyramid design, and pretended fan letters signed by such names as Eldridge Cleaver, Fidel Castro, Anton Zandor LaVey, or Judge Crater, all, of course, cooked up by his Lincoln Avenue audience. Later, however, it struck him that 3,125 was 5 to the 5th power, and that convinced him that a true Illuminatus was indeed communicating with him. He took the $3,125 out of his savings account, buried it as instructed, made a pro-Illuminati recording as a gesture of good faith, and waited. The next day, he was shot several times in the head and shoulders, dying of natural causes as a result. In present time again, Rebecca Goodman enters the Hotel Tudor lobby in answer to the second mysterious phone call of the day, while Hagbard decides George Dorn needs to be Illuminized further before Ingolstadt, and Esperando Despin clears his throat and says,
I want to explain the mathematics of plague to you men.
Actually, poor old Canvera's death had nothing to do with the Illuminati or with his former compatriots in Whore. The man had been practicing the libertine philosophy of his post-Om phone editorials and had tampered with Cassandra Akansi, the beloved daughter of Ronald Akansi, Chicago regional commander of God's Lightning and a longtime contributor to KCUF. Akansi arranged, via state's attorney Milo A. Flanagan, for the local moth to do a hit on Canvera. But there are no endings, any more than there are any beginnings. It next developed that Canvera's seed lived on in wedlock with Cassandra's ovum, and was in danger of becoming a human being within her previously trim abdomen. Saul Goodman had no idea that the room he was in had last been rented to George Dorn. He was conscious only of his impatience, not knowing that Rebecca was at that moment on an elevator approaching his floor. And a mile north, Peter Jackson, still trying to put together the July issue of Confrontation virtually single-handed, dives into the slush pile, which is the magazine industry's elegant name for unsolicited manuscripts, and comes up with more fallout from the Moon Malik Om project of 1970. Orthodox Science, the New Religion, he reads.
Well, let's sample it. What the hell?
Opening at random, he finds,
Einstein's concept of spherical space, furthermore, suffers from the same defect as the concept of a smoothly or perfectly spherical Earth. It rests upon the use of the irrational number pi. This number has no operational definition. There is no place on any engineer's scale to which one can point and say, this is exactly pi, although these scales are misleadingly marked with such a spot. Pi, in fact, can never be found in the real world, and there are historical and archaeological reasons to believe it was created by a Greek mathematician under the influence of the mind-warping hallucinogenic mushroom Amanita muscaria. It is pure surrealism. You cannot write pi as a real number. You can only approximate it as 3.1417, etc. Chemistry knows no such units. Three atoms of an element may combine with four atoms of another element, but you will never find pi atoms combining with anything. Quantum physics reveals that an electron may jump three units or four units, but it will not jump pi units. Nor is pi necessary to geometry, as is sometimes claimed. R. Buckminster Fuller has created an entire geometric system at least as reliable as that of the ancient Greek dope fiends, in which pi does not appear at all. Space, then, may be slanted or kiltered in various ways, but it cannot be smoothly spherical.
What the ring-tailed ramblin' hell?
Peter Jackson said aloud. He flipped to the end.
In conclusion, I want to thank a strange and uncommon man, James Mallison, who provided the spark which set me thinking about these matters. In fact, it was due to my meeting with Mr. Mallison that I sold my hardware business, returned to college, and majored in cartography and topology. Although he was a religious fanatic, as I was at the time of our meeting, and would therefore not appreciate many of my discoveries, it is due to this man's perverse, peculiar, and yet brilliant prodding that I embarked on the search which has led to this new theory of a pentahedroidal universe. W. Clement Kotex, Ph.D.
Far fucking out,
Peter muttered. James Mallison was a pen name Joe Malik sometimes used. And here was another James Mallison, inspiring this guy to become a Ph.D. and invent a new cosmological theory.
What was the word Joe used for such coincidences? Sync something.
1,472.
Esperando Despin concludes his gloomy mathematical calculations.
That's the number of plague cases we might have right now, at noon, if the girl had only two contacts after leaving Dr. Mocenigo. Now, if she had three contacts...
The assembled FBI agents are gradually turning a pale greenish color from the neck up. Cannell, the only actual contact, is busy two blocks away stuffing money into a briefcase.